Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And we're back. This is podcast 847, the B segment, a guest segment. And we have two wonderful guests. No book segment this time. This is on the medical marijuana, medical uses of marijuana and what you as a patient should know, should ask your physician, should inquire about, and should be concerned about or not. We'll get to that. The experts, Stephen and Meredith, they both have the same last name, although it's abbreviated in Meredith. It's Meredith Fisher-Corn and Stephen Corn. They are regarded so highly that their course from the answer page is the sole designation in New York State for education of physicians about medical marijuana, and is a lead provider in Florida and in many other states, including Massachusetts, where they're involved in the Harvard system. They work there. And in fact, I met them when I was at Brigham and Women's giving a grand rounds, I understand. Let me go and tell you my exposure to marijuana, if I can. I did a reverse Clinton. That is, I inhaled, but I didn't smoke. In the late 60s, the summer of love, if you went to the meadows in Golden Gate Park where I was, there was a yellow haze, and you couldn't help but inhale marijuana smoke, whether you smoked or not. So I did that reverse Clinton of inhaling but not lighting up. In any case, that's my exposure, and that's most doctors' exposure, meaning we have little expertise because it isn't an FDA-approved drug. Even the cannabinoids, that is the breakdown of THC and cannabinoids, things that are components of the marijuana plant, aren't, in fact, approved by the FDA. So let's get to that. If I can, I'm going to start with Meredith. Meredith, how did you get involved in this field, and what do you go about teaching docs when they first ask questions?
Well, the reason why we first got involved is Stephen and I were speaking about the laws changing in Massachusetts, and medical cannabis is just being legalized. And we're both anesthesiologists, but we knew very little about medical marijuana. And my son, who was 10 at the time, overheard our conversation, and he asked four phenomenal questions, and we could not answer them.
Actually, I'll just jump in. He turned to us and he said, and the conversation was completely appropriate. We were just discussing about the laws changing in Massachusetts. And both my wife and I had never tried medical cannabis or cannabis in general. It just was not something that we had an occasion to try. And he said, Dad, because what about carbon monoxide? That can't be good for you. And that was a rather good question for a 10-year-old. And he said, doesn't smoke produce cancer-causing chemicals? And what if you write a prescription? Now we know it's a certification. And then your patient has a car accident. Are you responsible? And he said, what about secondhand smoke if there are children in the house? And we turned to him. We said, these are incredible questions. And despite being, you know, Harvard faculty, being pain specialists, and reading all the literature, we haven't a clue to these answers. And we decided to look into it to get some answers. And what we found was that there was rather biased information out there. Most of the sources that we found said, you know, basically that cannabis is either the best thing in the world or the worst thing in the world. And we knew the answer had to be somewhere in the middle. And what concerned us was that we were concerned there were going to be really two extremes of doctors, those that just say no to their patients because they knew little about it or they just heard, you know, the negative aspects, or those who said yes and then tried to, you know, write certifications for their patients but then really weren't educated or had no great way to guide their patients. So what we
Let me go ahead and ask Michael, Stephen, as long as we're on this, I'm calling myself. Let's go and ask you, Stephen, if we can. Now, there's a difference between prescribing and recommending. As I understand, doctors can't prescribe because it's against the federal law, but you can recommend. What's the story on that?
Correct. So it's not a prescription because, as you rightfully said, it's not an FDA-cleared drug. So what it is you write a certification. And, for example, in Massachusetts, taking that state, for example, you would certify that your patient meets the requirements. So you're supposed to have a physician-patient relationship with the individual. You are supposed to see if that patient fulfills the disease states that have been approved. But in Massachusetts, unlike some of the other states, there's a little leeway where there is an other field where if you feel that the patient would benefit from medical cannabis but doesn't meet one of the specific disease states that are approved, you can write that in. And that would also satisfy the certification. And then
I'm going to keep interrupting only because I have so many questions to ask, and I don't want to lose all the questions. What disease states are approved, and are they different in different states? In other words, if it's approved for pain, which is, I understand, it might be for end-of-life pain or, if you will, chronic cancer pain. If it's approved for that in the state of Massachusetts, is it generally approved in all states that approve medical marijuana, the same indications?
Well, that's a great question, and there is some overlap. But unlike typical FDA, clear drugs, this makes it very difficult for patients. Because with an FDA-cleared drug, you can go from state to state. You don't have to worry what state you're in to worry what disease you have. And you can also transport your medicine across state lines. You can use it in the hospital. So, for example, in Massachusetts, if I'm getting this correct, it's different from state to state. But diseases such as cancer, with the pain of cancer, epilepsy, HIV and AIDS neuropathy, Huntington's disease, inflammatory bowel disease, multiple sclerosis with spasticity, and ALS are approved. New York State, for example, is in the process of approving PTSD and recently approved chronic pain. So it's actually very variable from state to state. And, for example, Florida initially approved had a much more stringent approval, and they limited the treatment initially to low THC preparation or high cannabidiol preparation.
There are different, what we call cannabinoids, that is, they're different components of the marijuana plant that one can get through different techniques, smoking, purifying the oils, etc. And so they have different effects. So let's talk about that, if you would. And I'm going to call on Meredith. Meredith, tell us about the different cannabinoid oils and the difference of smoking versus eating versus oils. And then I want to get to one more subject as a lead-in. Many of our listeners are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, and this is not your grandfather's grass anymore.
Right. So cannabis is made up of multiple components called cannabinoids. In cannabis, there's over 100 different cannabinoids. The two most well-studied cannabinoids are tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, as most people know it, or cannabidiol, or CBD. THC is responsible for many of the therapeutic effects produced by cannabis, but it is also a psychoactive component, meaning that it may cause a psychosis or a dysphoria. CBD, however, also has many therapeutic effects, but it does not cause the psychosis that THC does. And to address your other question about modes of administration.
So make sure you're still there. Mike, are you still there?
I absolutely am still here.
Okay. Okay. I heard a click.
There are different modes of administration. Many states actually do not allow smoking. They do allow vaporization, but not smoking. Edibles are another form of administration. Oral sprays. Some states allow for topical use. Others allow for rectal suppositories, and most states allow for oils given orally, and also pills.
And as Meredith mentioned,
is the cannabinoid small enough to be absorbed in an oil from your skin?
There's multiple studies on that, and different cannabinoids have different penetrating abilities. So I can't answer your question completely because it's cannabinoid dependent.
And okay, getting now, to the...
Go ahead.
The vaporization, that goes back to our son's question, because unlike smoking, with vaporization, you only heat the material to a point below combustion, so you're actually not generating carbon monoxide. And that, you know, that goes back to my son's question when he was 10 about, you know, what about carbon monoxide? So these have very different profiles, as does, you know, the edible route. Uptake and distribution is very, very different depending on the route.
Now, I only know of one study from Johns Hopkins of hookah parlor use of cannabinoids, that is vaporization or smoking it, and at least the inflammatory response from that study, that is looking at the inflammation that caused, was the equivalent, 1 hour in a hookah parlor was the equivalent of 16 to 20 23 cigarettes, 16 to 23 from that 1 hour in the variation. And the question I have is, does... Now, vaporization in a non-hookah parlor, that is in a setting, does that also cause inflammation, or is that unique to the hookah parlor, if you will, accumulation of stuff?
It's our understanding, and we'll refer the readers and the doctors to the course material with the references. It's our understanding that with vaporization, there's much less inflammation. It's a very different profile.
And when you say most states have, or states have different things from pill form to oil form to edibles, is the safety profile of those different preparations, I suppose it hasn't been extensively studied as much because it isn't they're not required to do FDA-type studies. And so maybe you can speak about that, Stephen.
That's a very good question. There's actually a considerable amount of work on this. And so in terms of route of administration, so people very often assume that taking something the edible route would be, you know, a less invasive or a more mild way of taking the medication, the cannabis, than vaporizing or even smoking. But what happens is the time course, you know this very well as an anesthesiologist, is, you know, when you smoke or vaporize, it very quickly gets into the bloodstream, gets to the brain, and you get a desired effect, and you can very easily titrate or match your dose to what you need. But with the edible route, there's can be a time lag of 60, 90 minutes or more. It can be, you know, much more than that before you get an effect. And what some people have done, and you probably have read about this in the news, people have taken more and more in that first 60 minutes because they really weren't getting an effect. But then they get a dramatic effect or a dysphoric effect or really gotten ill from it because they didn't look at the time course. And that's why it's so important for doctors to understand this. People who will be making these recommendations really need the education so that they can really guide their patients and say, no, if you do something via the edible route, you need to give it time to really have an effect. It's going to be very different than if your friend told you, well, I vaporized and I had an effect within minutes or less. So the route of administration makes a very big difference. And we go into that in great detail in the course.
Now, talk to me in these courses. What is the most effective use of this? Is it for cancer pain? Is it for cancer, what we would call inanition, not eating at all? Is it for chemotherapy-related diseases? Is it for, if you will, spasticity? Is it for pain? What would you say If you said this is probably the use that we have most data on and the best uses?
Well, the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine came out with a significantly sized report at the beginning of this year, and they had basically evaluated multiple studies, and they came up with various conclusions. And one of they concluded that there is conclusive or substantial evidence that cannabis or cannabinoids are effective for the treatment of chronic pain in adults, as antiemetics in the treatment of chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, and for improving patient-reported multiple sclerosis spasticity symptoms.
So those are the strongest recommendations from this very comprehensive report.
And where can if our listeners want to get that report or refer their doctors to it, in addition to going to the answer page, where's the original report?
It's on the National Academies of Sciences and Engineering.
So it's in the National Academy website.
Exactly. Right. And it came out in January 2017. It's about a 300-400-page report.
I was going to tell people, if they want to get it or refer their doctors to it, their doc ain't likely to go through it in detail, because these are really detailed reports.
Right. There is a summary.
They've done a nice job creating a summary, and we've also integrated all that information into our coursework. But they did a very nice job summarizing their strong indication.
And now I'm going to ask some questions that are maybe a little weird. When is it approved in Massachusetts, or has it been yet for? Is it totally approved and able to be used in Massachusetts?
You mean for recreational?
For medical use.
Oh, medical, yeah. It was approved in 2012, and that's when we launched our course. And since that time, the Massachusetts Medical Society has been linking directly to us as the resource for medical cannabis education.
So 2012. Is it approved for recreational use now?
It was approved
this election.
It just was approved.
So when will that be able to be purchased in Massachusetts?
I have to check on that, because things get delayed and litigation comes up and things go back and forth. But I think the anticipated date is 2018.
So that's very similar to Ohio's use medically. What have we learned from Colorado and the state of Washington in their, if you will, release of recreational use? Do we know, does it increase abuse? Does it decrease abuse of opiates and alcohol? What are the general effects from recreational use? And I realize you guys have concentrated on medical use, so if you want to beg off those questions, feel free.
Yeah, I'll beg off in a sense, because it would take a lot more than the time that we have to actually look at the studies, because there's varied studies and varied strengths of the studies. And a lot of the studies do, when they get into recreational, it's very hard to sort out concomitant use of other things such as alcohol and opioids. But I will mention one thing. There's the JAMA study, Journal of the American Medical Association study, which is rather compelling, where they looked at states that introduced medical cannabis. And the states that introduced medical cannabis, if I'm quoting this correctly, deaths due to opioids went down by 24%. So as a physician who feels, and as a pain specialist who still feels rather limited in terms of the options that, you know, one has for treating patients' pain, that's rather compelling evidence, especially, you know, with the concerns about the opioid epidemic.
Now, let me go and go to both of you, since you are pain specialists. Is there, or have you found, this is an alternative medically, meaning certifying people, have you found this is a useful alternative in the chronic non-cancer pain? And then same question for the chronic cancer pain, and then same question for acute pain.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, since we're not treating directly, and our focus is on education. It's through reports, anecdotal, and also reading the literature. But the feedback that we're getting is that it's dramatically helping many patients, moderately helping others. But one of the big things that patients are reporting that seems to be a real bonus and a real positive aspect is that they're able to decrease the number of other medications that they're on, and they're able to use this to improve their functioning. So they're able to, most of these patients are not looking to get, big doses of cannabis. What they're trying to do is take just enough so they can function in their everyday life and really, get back to doing what they need to do. So, anecdotally and through reports from colleagues, that's what we're finding. And then, if you look at this National Academy of Science report, which I think is really well done, we mentioned the conclusive evidence, but they've also discussed, for this moderate evidence that it helps with short-term, sleep outcomes. It helps with fibromyalgia, chronic pain, and other syndromes. And then it also mentions that there's limited evidence for increasing appetite, improving symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and I mentioned that was just recently being approved in New York as an indication. So this report and what we put in, really lays it out. And you can look at it, each disease state individually and each problem individually and see the strength of the evidence.
So I want to thank the combination of Stephen Cohn and Meredith
Korn.
Korn. And their website is theanswerpage.com.
Correct.
You should refer your physicians to that. I understand about half of the states and a little more than half of the population is now can access medical marijuana, and increasingly every year. And this is, they have great resources, as you've heard, as well as great knowledge for your physician to learn more about this. Me too. I plan on trying to take one of their courses sometime when it comes to Ohio. Ohio has just approved this. Now, I should say, in addition, we have not talked a lot about side effects for the brain when you expose this to young children or kids or teenagers, especially male teenagers, until their brain matures. We should get into that. I'm going to ask them to come back. They obviously have so much knowledge about this. So I want to thank you guys for coming on. These are the Korns. The website is theanswerpage.com. You should refer your physician to that. Even write them an email and tell them about it, because my guess is this is a marvelous website, as these are really substantial, as you've heard, experts in the field. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next Tuesday with another new Best of the Medical News, where you get to take control of your health on You, the Owner's Manual podcast. Sonar, thanks for great engineering. And, of course, the Korns for great information, and you for listening.